animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Dr. Sue Ettinger, a veterinary cancer specialist, author, podcaster, YouTuber, and speaker, including being slated to deliver lectures at the Veterinary Meeting and Expo, or VMX. What's billed as the world's largest veterinary conference held in Orlando, getting underway on Saturday. One of approximately 400 board-certified specialists in medical oncology in North America, Ettinger functions under something of an alias, which is Dr. Sue, Cancer Vet. A guiding principle of her work as a practicing vet and wearing her other hats is raising awareness, cancer awareness, from which she has developed the See Something, Do Something, Why Wait, Aspirate program to promote early cancer detection and diagnosis. We'll discuss these principles and programs and other aspects of cancer in pets, and as usual, incorporate your calls, emails, and texts into the conversation when I speak with Dr. Sue Ettinger in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the program, I'll play back a brief interview I recorded last night with Dr. Jennifer Conrad, founder of the Paw Project, about the announcement a few days ago that the Banfield National Chain of Pet Hospitals will no longer support declaw surgery. The Paw Project assisted in this change, of course. And the interview with Dr. Conrad, we touched on this shift, the implications of it, and more. We'll hear that conversation later in today's show, followed by my mentioning a major honor for Dr. Conrad that I didn't even know about while speaking with her last night. So all that's to come later. Lastly, I thought I would mention that my latest animal-related story for the Washington Post was published yesterday. In the piece, I examined the disease that has annihilated Florida's $9 billion citrus industry, and the specially trained dogs who can now detect the disease dramatically faster and more accurately than other methods. Among other things, the story serves as a reminder of just how magical dogs can be. For instance, read it, you can search online with Washington Post and my name or citrus disease dogs, something like that, or just find it posted yesterday on any of my social media pages. Right now, though, let's get to my conversation with Dr. Sue, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Dr. Sue Ettinger on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Dr. Ettinger.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
I am. It's a little bit choppy on my end, but I'm glad that you can hear me. That's what matters.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we'll kick this up a little bit. Maybe that'll help. Anyway, so thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals this morning.
It's an honor to be here.
Cool. So I feel like there's much to cover with you. Cancer in pets is such a monumentally important topic, but I want to at least touch on your background a bit. For one thing, I've spoken to so many people over the years on the show who are involved with animals in one capacity or another, who early on thought they wanted to be veterinarians and then changed course. You obviously are a veterinarian, so I'm curious, when did you want to become one?
So I'm one of those classic stories of, you know, someone who wanted to be a veterinarian when they were a kid. My parents tell me there's, you know, a picture, you know, that I drew in kindergarten that I wanted to be a vet when I was a kid. I did dabble in other interests when I was in undergrad at Tufts University. I did think about going into art history, but I'm glad that I stuck with veterinary medicine.
Wow, that's quite a potential detour. So did you take some art history classes and say, and seriously think, hey, maybe I'll go this path?
I did. And I did a semester abroad. Tufts really encouraged that. And I was lucky enough, I studied in Florence.
Oh, geez.
Amazing.
So yeah.
I still have that love for art history, but I'm really glad that I stuck with veterinary medicine as my career.
Yeah. Hanging out in Florence at that point, I'm glad we didn't lose you to art history. So obviously then you did go to vet school. When did you decide your focus would be cancer?
So I'm a late bloomer in the world of oncology, to tell you the truth. So when I was at vet school at Cornell, I actually thought I wanted to be a surgeon. And Cornell did not have an oncology program, a dedicated oncology program when I was there. So it was during my internship at the Animal Medical Center in New York City that I really had my first immersion into the world of oncology. And like many other people, including pet owners, you know, one of the first questions people often say to me as a cancer specialist is, gosh, your job must be so depressing. You know, people think I poison dogs and cats for a living. You know, and they're innocent questions, right? You know, most of us know people, you know, family members, friends who have gone through chemotherapy, and chemo in people is really tough. And so we think that dogs and cats going through chemotherapy are going to suffer. And I was really surprised when I started treating dogs and cats during my internship at AMC that they had this really good quality of life, and it was just a very different experience. And I thought, well, maybe I could do surgical oncology. That's sort of a subspecialty that there is in veterinary surgery. But I actually applied for a surgery residency, and one of my, you know, I look back at that failure as a gift that I did not match for a surgery residency, because that sort of detoured me and I got really interested in oncology, and I changed my career path and I changed my focus, and I decided to become a medical oncologist instead of a surgeon. So, you know, people often look at failures and they don't like to talk about it, but that failure for me was such a gift because it allowed me to then decide to become an oncologist.
Isn't it interesting how many failures, as you're calling them, but just sort of flukes or twists of fate or just circumstantial things have led to people finding exactly what they should be doing?
Yeah, and I really believe that oncology is exactly what I should be doing.
Yeah, it sure seems like it from what I can tell from here. Nonetheless, I'd be curious, especially as you were making that shift, did you have any trepidation about heading into a field where, sadly, you were going to lose more patients than, say, a vet going into a general practice, let's say?
You know, I didn't know that I thought about that as I was getting into oncology. I was really, one of the things, the little geek inside of me loves the science behind oncology and sort of the cellular stuff that a lot of people like, oh my God, I hate. So that was another thing that interested me about oncology. But what I think that I loved about oncology is the quality of life that the dogs and cats have and the bond that you develop with the owners as they're going through. And I think, you know, what I love is, you know, the quality of time that these patients have with their families. And I really focus on that. And so even though it's really sad when we say goodbye, I think the time that these families have with their pets, and, you know, I look, you know, the emails and the messages and now the direct messages that I get from these families thanking me for the time that they were able to have. So, you know, they often come in with such fear and they're scared when they come to see me, and, you know, these patients, and they're like, because of you, we had 14 more months with our dog, because of you, you know, sometimes years more with their family members. And so to me, that's what I focus on, even though the loss is heartbreaking and none of us want to go through that pain. But one of my dear friends, one of my veterinary colleagues say, you know, it's the price of admission, that pain. And I try to focus on the time that we get to have with our pets and all the good joy that they bring us and the joy that we bring them. So, you know, to me, that the sadness that when we lose them is part of it, but that's not, to me, the focus of what I do.
Well, it sounds like almost necessarily, as with your friend's suggestion, that you needed to become kind of philosophical about it. Otherwise, how could you really carry on? You'd just be torn up every time, probably.
Yeah.
So I think we've kind of mentioned earlier and touched on briefly already that a crucial tenet of your philosophy is promoting early detection of cancer.
Yeah.
So for those of us with dogs and or cats who have not been diagnosed at the moment, what should we be doing? What should we be on the lookout for to really be as early in the game as possible?
Yeah, so, you know, a couple of things. So one, you know, one of my key programs that I have is a lumps and bumps program that you mentioned in the introduction. And so that is to look for skin and subcutaneous tumors, so things that we can feel. And so we know with these tumors, if we can find them early, they can often have a really good good prognosis. And so I really recommend, and what I've tried to do is make a lot of videos and make everything really accessible. So it's really important. I'm not trying to replace a veterinarian. It's really important that you see your veterinarian on a regular basis, but I also want to give you information to, you know, in between those appointments to educate you. So I have a YouTube channel, and one of the videos is all about how to find these lumps and bumps. And I really recommend once a month when you're doing your flea and tick preventative that you do a lump and bump exam from nose to tail, and that you're looking for any lumps and bumps. And then I have these skin maps that you can print out and note where they are, because it's really hard to remember where stuff is. But the key of that program, if the mass is the size of a pea, which is also the size of an M&M or a Skittle, and been there a month, you want to mark it down and you want to go to your veterinarian, and we can do a simple test called an aspirate, where we stick a needle in, collect some cells, and just figure out if it's benign or malignant. But early detection is so important. So again, that's just one way that we can find these lumps or bumps. And the reason I started this program is I was seeing, as many vets do, these lumps and bumps that are just way too big, and we're just missing the opportunity to remove them when they're small. And then we're just, you know, we have more costly procedures or lumps and bumps that are too big to be removed. So that's really the importance of this see something, do something, why wait, aspirate program. So that's one thing that we can do for our dogs and cats.
Yeah. Well, I think simultaneously, I think with your describing it, an email that came in, so this may be pretty timely. It says, question for Dr. Sue. Thoughts about doing a biopsy on any lumps that appear? I have had a number of dogs with cancer going through it now, and have read different views about whether or not aspirating or a biopsy could cause cancer to spread.
So that's a great question, and you know, it's one of those myths that out there. So an aspirate and a biopsy are a little bit different. I like an aspirate because it's a less invasive and less costly procedure. And for most lumps and bumps, you're going to be able to figure out if it's benign or malignant, and then what the next steps are going to be. There are going to be some lumps and bumps where you're going to get something called a non-diagnostic, where they're not going to be able to figure it out, and then you're going to do a biopsy. And that's where you take a little core of tissue. But neither aspirates or biopsies are going to cause them to spread for the skin and subcutaneous ones. There are some, you know, I can't make generalizations for everything out there. There are some cancers like bladder cancer where doing the aspirate has a low risk of tracking it through the skin. But I'll be honest, and this is a little controversial, you know, there's pluses and minuses of still doing the aspirate, and I'll walk the owner through that, because some of the more invasive procedures to get the diagnosis can be more costly. So, you know, it's hard to make blanket statements. But aspirates and biopsies are still, you know, usually really good ways, because if you don't find out what it is and you just let it grow and get bigger, there's negatives there as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So under your lumps and bumps, if I'm checking out my animal while we're doing the flea thing, like you say, or whatever, so if I hit anything really of any size that I at least don't recall being there the last time, then I immediately say, okay, maybe we at least call the vet, or maybe do we go right pretty much to saying, hey, let's find out what's in here and aspirate?
No, I mean, I would mark it down. I would print out the skin map, and it's on my website, Dr. Sue Cancer Vet, in the pet owner resource section. And the reason I tell you don't have to run right in is because sometimes, you know, dogs and cats have benign reactions. So, you know, because they bump into, you know, they're playing with the other dog in the house, and they can just have, you know, like a bump, you know, an innocent bump that's going to resolve on its own in the next 2 weeks because it's scar tissue or something like that. So they can have benign reactions that are not always cancer. So it's reasonable to say, okay, I'm going to measure it now, and then, oh, in 2 weeks it's smaller, it went away, we don't need to go into the vet. But, oh, look, it's still there a month later, let's go into the vet and do something. Or, oh, look, it got bigger in 2 weeks, I'm going to do something. So, you know, the reason that we set that guideline for a month is because, again, I've seen things get too bigger, and then I've seen things come in, you know, the size of golf balls and tennis balls, you know, which are, you know, 6 centimeters, you know, and really large, and owners are kind of shocked that we can't get, you know, do anything for them. So again, that's why we went with the size of a pea, which again is which is half the size of a penny. I always try to use everyday objects, because doctors like to talk in centimeters and inches, but that doesn't really mean anything to most people.
Yeah.
I usually try to talk in everyday objects.
No, I think that's really helpful and keeps it simple. And also, I would think if you're just checking out your animal and you hit anything that seems new or unusual, I mean, hopefully it would never get the size of a golf ball or anything. I mean, I guess I would understand how that can happen. But it just seems like if you felt something amiss or that, hey, that wasn't here 6 weeks ago or a few weeks ago or whatever, it just seems like right away that would raise a red flag of sorts, even if you say, okay, you don't have to go screaming out of the living room and over to the vet right then, but mark it down, watch it for a month, see where we are, but at least pay attention to it and proceed from there.
Yeah, and I do want to point out, like, you know, even though I feel really passionately about this lumps and bumps program, there are other warning signs of cancer, and they're pretty well known. I've made part one and part two video of, you know, the top 10 warning signs of cancer, and a lot of them are really going to be, you know, go back to routine care with your vet. And some of them are simple things like keeping track of your dog or your cat's weight. And I'll be honest, a lot of this, you know, I'm a pet owner too, and my husband is a veterinary internist, so he's a specialist as well. And we had one of our own cats lose a lot of weight in front of our eyes. And I think as a pet owner, it can be really hard to, you know, our animals are fluffy and they can lose muscle, they can lose weight. So, you know, there are things that we can do, and some of that's just going to the vet regularly, making sure they're not losing weight, you know, their appetite, vomiting, diarrhea, you know, limping. So a lot of these are things that, you know, because they can be signs, and not, I don't want everybody to get so alarmist, like, my dog's limping, it has to be bone cancer. My dog has blood in their urine, it has to be bladder cancer, because it could be something more benign like a urinary tract infection. But as our pets age, cancer becomes more likely. So, you know, but an early detection does make a difference. So I just want people to have it on their radar, because what frustrates me is when I see these cases that things have been going on for 6 months, you know, multiple urinary tract infections that have been treated, but there was underlying bladder cancer, or the dog has been limping and it's been treated with a lot of pain medications and there was bone cancer underneath. And there are certain breeds that bone cancer is going to be more likely, and there are certain breeds that, you know, bladder cancer could be more likely. So I think we just need to do our homework and be aware of these issues so we can try to find them. And again, talk to your veterinarian, see your vet regularly. And people say, what is regularly? You know, as our pets age, it's really twice a year. And people say, gosh, that's quite frequently. But that's you or me going to the doctor every couple of years, because our pets age more frequently. So it does mean getting to the vet quite frequently in our calendar, you know, but it is going to be really important.
That's, I think, really good points, because, again, I think the idea is, like you say, to not freak out, not be alarmist, but by the same token, take things seriously and don't just let things go if you're starting to feel something amiss or see something amiss in the dog's weight loss or a cat or whatever that just doesn't seem right. So I think it sounds like if you can strike some sort of balance between that, then you're still way on the early detection side, should it be cancer. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just joined us, my guest is Dr. Sue Ettinger, a veterinary cancer specialist whose alter ego of sorts is Dr. Sue Cancer Vet. If you'd like to ask Dr. Sue a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Let's get one of our callers involved. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Sue.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. It's you.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Lori.
Hi.
And thanks
Hi,
for
Lori.
Taking my call.
Hi, Doctor.
So I have a 9-year-old Great Dane, and he's rescue. And he, a few months ago, started just getting lipomas everywhere. And so at this point, the last veterinarian that we've seen, and I actually did have the body mapping done by, you know, his old veterinarian, took it into the new vet, and she didn't seem to take it very seriously, like we should continue to keep looking. And I don't know if that's because of his age, but he really does. I mean, he's lipomas all over, and he did have one infiltrative lipoma. He had the surgery, they got out as much as they could, and fortunately it's not come back and infiltrated again. But what's your thought or opinion about dogs that just get so many lipoma that it seems like they'd be doing aspirate, you know, for hours? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's hard. And, you know, one of the the inspiration for my See Something, Do Something program is Smokey, and he belonged to, and I tell the story in the video, but he belonged to my head technician, and over the years he had many lipomas, and somewhere after his 10th lipoma, he had a malignant soft tissue connective tumor called a soft tissue sarcoma, and it was 7 centimeters, so it was quite big, and it required a big surgery, and he had a bunch of other medical conditions, and it really hit home because Amanda and I had gotten complacent because everything else had been benign. So I'm not saying that your sweet Great Dane's next lumbar bump is going to be something malignant, but it just goes to show that we can't predict what the next lumbar bump will be, and we just have to keep on track of it. And there are definitely lumpy, bumpy dogs who have multiple lumps and bumps, but it takes vigilance and aspirating and keeping track of them. And just making sure that the next one continues to be a lipoma. And if a lipoma has some sort of surgence in growth, you know, you have to take action on it. So I know it's frustrating, to keep on top of them.
Does it feel different? Like, would a cancerous tumor feel
no,
different?
No, I always tell people I can't look at a mass, I can't feel a mass and know what it is. I've had dogs come in with 2 lumps or bumps, and the one that I think is going to be something, like, you just don't know.
Okay.
I've had ones that I think are going to be lipomas turn out to be mast cell tumors and vice versa. So it's frustrating. I wish I could tell you that there's a way to look and feel and know what a lump or bump is, but we can't.
Right.
And that's where poking and looking at the cells under a microscope are going to be so important.
Right.
Okay, thank you for your call.
The only other thing I wanted to say is, I know so many people who want to be responsible and do exactly what you're saying and take their pets in every, twice a year and get all these things done, but the cost is just becoming so out of reach for so many people. So throw that in there. Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. So we've got another call or two we want to get to and some emails. In fact, one of our emails is from our Greyhound correspondent, Don Goldstein. It says, of the 11 Greyhounds I've adopted, we have lost 4 to osteosarcoma. We are hearing about a possible vaccine for osteosarcoma. Any truth to the rumors?
Yeah, so there are, the rumors are true. So so it's the most common bone cancer that we see in dogs. And greyhounds are definitely one of the breeds that we see it. It is a cancer that is, I say, two battlefronts. So it's locally aggressive in the bone. It has a very high spread rate. Chemo is good, so you want to remove the tumor. So usually most dogs get amputation, though there are other, what we call alternative options. But most dogs will end up getting amputation and then chemo. But it doesn't cure them of their cancer. And so there's been this osteosarcoma vaccine. It's an immunotherapy. So most of us, when we hear vaccine, we think of like rabies vaccine to prevent. It's not a prevention, it's a treatment, and it's done after the surgery typically and the chemo, and then they get this immunotherapy to target the cancer cells. It was developed at the University of Penn, Pennsylvania, by Nicola Mason, Dr. Mason, and has now been, it's just the clinical trial just closed by Aratana, which was just bought out by Elanco, and they're looking, it's no longer available, so it was in clinical trials at about 22 sites. I was at one of the hospitals that was at the site. The dogs would get 3 vaccines 3 weeks apart, again, after the amputation, after the vaccine. The original data that came out of Pennsylvania, at the University of Pennsylvania, was very exciting because usually dogs that had surgery and amputation, I'm sorry, amputation plus chemo, would live about a year. And the dogs that were getting this vaccine in the original study, they were living about almost 950 days, almost doubling to tripling the time. Really, really promising data. So now we're waiting for the data to come out of the clinical trial, and hopefully it'll be something that will be commercially available to oncologists, in practice. But right now, there's always that frustrating time, right, when something's in development where, they've done the data or they've done the clinical trials, and now we have to anxiously wait for the data to be crunched, and then hopefully we can get it. But it's not something that, I even have my hands, that I have access to at this point. So really cool. But again, it's something called immunotherapy. immunotherapy. They do some immunotherapy in people. We do have some immunotherapy, like for the melanoma, malignant melanomas in dogs, but, you know, really cool stuff, but that's about what I know about it at this point.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dr. Sue.
That's the Cliff Notes version on it. I could go into more how it works and things like that, but I think that's sort of a good enough summary, don't you think?
That's perfect for right now. Thank you
perfect.
So much. In your practice, given that you're a cancer specialist, are you mostly treating an animal that's already been diagnosed, or are you just as likely to be helping diagnose an animal?
In general, in my practice, and probably most oncologists, we typically see cases that have been diagnosed usually by general practitioners
mm-hmm.
or the internist, sometimes by surgeons because they've done the biopsies. So, like, the next appointment that I'm seeing after this interview is a kitty cat with gastrointestinal lymphoma, one of the most common cancers that we see in cats. This kitty had, I already read the record, he had weight loss. The diagnosis was confirmed by our internist who did the aspirates of the gastrointestinal mass, and I'll be talking to the owners about starting chemotherapy today. So in general, the workup has been done. Sometimes I'll do some additional tests, you know, to kind of finish the staging, the diagnostics, if, you know, there's anything that's going to help me for prognosis or, you know, additional tests that haven't been done yet. But usually the diagnosis has been made by the primary care veterinarian or one of the other specialists at my practice or another practice.
So it sounds like it's pretty directly equivalent to in a human situation where someone's diagnosed and then one of the first steps often at least is to start consulting with an oncologist. So it sounds like that's really pretty much a direct parallel.
And what I would think is really important for pet owners to know is that I always tell people that the consultation with a cancer specialist is a no-obligation consultation. A lot of people think, oh my goodness, I'm going to be pressured to treat. And I always tell people, just go and get the information. You know, you can go get the information, talk about chemotherapy, talk about the initial diagnostics. You don't have to do anything at that initial appointment. You know, and again, there are some cancers that are more slow-moving and there are some that are more quick-moving, but get the information. Education is power. A lot of clients are so scared about chemotherapy, and then they hear, wow, 80% of dogs and cats have no side effects. And there's different plans. It's not all or nothing. And maybe I'll do this plan, or maybe I'll treat with this. And wow, we can give this medication to support appetite. So I think people are often so scared because we have so many myths and misconceptions about cancer in pets. So I think it's really important to get the information. And again, that's why I make those videos, is to kind of make it a little less scary for people about it, because so many people come and they'll say, I'm never going to give chemo to my pet. And then they're like, oh, you know what? I'll try it. And then they're like, I'm coming back. And then they keep coming back. And so many times a general practitioner is like, I can't believe they're treating. And then they see the pet, they're like, I can't believe how well the pet's doing. And so I think it's so scary and overwhelming. So again, you don't have to treat at that first appointment, but I think it's often worthwhile to get the information.
Yeah, and it sounds like, as you talked about earlier on, I mean, a lot of people, if they just don't have any direct experience with it, they think, well, no, she just gives the animals poison. Or, I mean, it's like just coming from a place of inexperience and or fear, and you just think, well, they can't help my animal, and it's just going to make them feel worse, and far from it, as we're seeing over and over.
And sometimes the goal of the family is pain management, and then we can talk about that, or nutritional support or things like that. So my job is always figure out what the goal of the family is and then work with them from there. So it doesn't have to be like full aggressive chemo or, you know, full surgery. Like, it could be, you know, what we call palliative comfort support. So, you know, it's just having an open conversation with what the goals are.
So I have a question sort of related to that, or at least related to diagnosis, but let's read another email. My wife and I lost our 8-year-old golden retriever in March of last year. In October, she had developed fluid around her heart, but all tests that were run did not show she had cancer. Then last March, she had tumors all throughout her chest wall. Our golden retriever is more prone to dying from cancers than other breeds. And then, I guess, kind of as an aside, asks, what is your opinion of grain-free diets for dogs?
Oh, that's a loaded. I don't know that I can answer. So the grain-free diet is a tough one. But, you know, goldens are a high-risk cancer breed, unfortunately. So I have two Labradors, and they're not quite as high risk, but they are a high risk breed as well. But I would, you know, do want to say no breed is risk free, and I see plenty of cancer in mixed breed dogs as well. But you know, Morris Animal Foundation is, you know, the process of doing that. I think they're tracking 2,000 or 3,000 golden retriever. It's a lifetime study, which will be really interesting, not just for cancer, but for other diseases as well. But goldens are a high risk breed. So I think if that's your breed of choice, you just have to know that. And screening is, you know, something that you should talk about with your veterinarian to an early detection and things like that. So they are a high risk breed to Amston.
Yeah. And it sounds like in this case, it was trickier because it sounds like the dog was getting good vet care and had these issues and the fluid around the heart, but I guess the cancer just wasn't seen or detectable till obviously far too late. So
yeah, and and sometimes quote unquote we can do all the right things and pets are still going to get cancer.
Yeah.
And you can do all the wrong things and someone's still not going to get cancer. So
yeah.
You know, it's not always that simple.
Sure,
but I do think there are things that we can do. Early detection, you know, we're learning, and a lot of these are probably discussions that we would have to have another day. But what is the role of early spay and neuter? Very controversial, but we do know that there's probably a protective benefit. And the one study that they did this was in goldens, and it looks like there is a protective benefit in delaying spaying and neuter in goldens in some cancers. I can't say across all cancers, but that, you know, leaving estrogen and progesterone and testosterone in the system of golden retrievers can protect against some cancers and joint diseases as well. So, you know, but that's not the only thing. That doesn't mean that leaving your dog intact or delaying when you spay and neuter them will guarantee that they won't get cancer. The grain-free diet, you know, that opens up another conversation because there's concerns about whether or not it's potentially detrimental to some heart diseases and, that's why
super complicated.
Super complicated.
Yeah.
I don't think grains are bad. I think it's, to me, more important to look at where your grains are coming from. And I think that there are minerals and other things that are in grains that could be important. So, a lot of it goes back to people thought, like, grains feed cancer and things like that. So I'm not against grains. I just think we should have, our grains should be coming from high quality. You know, you don't want, you know, looking at GMOs and things like that. And so I think it's just high quality food. I think, you know, good fruits and vegetables and, you know, there are studies that show that dogs that get fruits and vegetables, but again, you don't want raisins and grapes and onions and things like that in their diet, can prevent against some cancers like bladder cancer. So again, I think we can do other things to supplement their diets that could be helpful without just saying grain-free.
Okay, cool. So this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Dr. Sue Ettinger, though you can call her Dr. Sue Cancer Vet. If you'd like to ask Dr. Sue...
would be fine.
Okay, Dr. Sue. All right, if you'd like to ask Dr. Sue a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. Dr. Sue, it would appear that one hallmark of your career is projecting a sense of really seeking to communicate. I mean, you're writing, you're lecturing, you're podcasting, you preside over your own YouTube channel. So there's it's a lot of time and effort beyond the demands of being a practicing veterinarian. Why is communicating in all these ways so important to you? I have a sense of what it does for others, pet owners, obviously, but what does it do for you?
That's a good question. I think for me, over the years, raising cancer awareness and outreach has just become something so important to me. And I think starting in 2015 was when I first spoke at VMX, which was still called NAVC at the time. That was my first major big conference. And I think I got bit by the speaking bug where I just got this amazing feedback. And I just realized I love what I do in practice. I love helping families through probably one of the darkest moments and, you know, their pet family lives. But I realized that there was this opportunity to impact more veterinarians and more pet and more families, and that I had a positive voice in talking about cancer, this live longer, live well philosophy that mm-hmm. I really believe, and that cancer is a treatable disease and cancer is not a death sentence. And over the last, I guess, five, years, I've scaled back my practice to 2 days a week. It was a slow process, and I've increased my speaking, and, you know, and social media has been growing at that time. And so it just became another way to reach more families. And I have people that follow me in Australia and England, and I don't really get much out of it except for that personal satisfaction that I'm reaching more people. And when someone says to me, you know, I started the See Something, Do Something program, I don't know, 7, 8 years ago, and someone will say, I found a lump or bump, I went to my vet, I insisted they do an aspirate, we found a mast cell tumor, we removed it with clean and wide margins, it was low grade, and my dog has a great prognosis. Thank you, Dr. Sue. I don't know.
Yeah.
It just, it makes you feel good, and you like, you go to bed happy that day.
Yeah.
And it, that's what's in it for me.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
That's what's in it for me.
Yeah. No, that's great, because it's like this probably magnified sense that as much as practicing day to day had similar rewarding moments, if somebody halfway across the globe is saying, hey, I looked at your thing and it made me do this, this, and this, and now our dog is this as a result. Thank you. I mean, that's got to be a tremendous feeling.
And sometimes there are veterinarians who maybe when they were in vet school or they got into practice, because not everybody is as maybe hopeful about treating cancer. And so sometimes I'll get a message or an email from a vet and they'll say, you know, I went to your lecture 9 months ago and I just saw a lymphoma case. And because of your lecture, I spoke to them about treating and they're going to treat. And I'm like, that's really cool, right?
Yeah.
So that's what's in it for me. And I just love teaching. I love connecting with veterinarians and technicians and other veterinary professionals. And you know what? I think teaching makes me a better clinician. It makes me, you know, you stay on top of your game. It keeps you current. I just love everything about it. So
yeah, no, that's great. And there's not only an obvious enthusiasm that comes across, but related to that, and I think that's sort of what you're touching on here, is there's an optimism that you project. So it might come down to if an animal's diagnosed, kind of the glass half empty or the glass half full approach, and you're a half full person.
Most of the time.
Okay. Well, all right. Okay. Well, let's take another call while we ponder that. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Dr. Sue.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. It's you.
It's me. Okay. This is Kathy. Hey, great talking to you both. I read your book. It's wonderful. I've told a lot of people about it. My question is, my 10-year-old rescue schnauzer was diagnosed with anal cancer in October. He had the surgery. It was a small lump. They removed it. There were narrow margins, but they were clean. He had no evidence that it was in his lymph nodes. So I took him to an oncologist who suggested one of two approaches, either radiation, 19 weeks of that, or heavy surveillance, meaning ultrasound every 3 to 4 months and an anal gland check. So I opted for surveillance. And I'm also, let me regress 1 second. He did say that he did not think that chemotherapy worked. So anyway, I opted for surveillance. I'm also taking him to a holistic veterinarian. And it's a little challenging with him because he's had a bad 6 months. He has. He was diagnosed with pancreatitis in August, and also he has bladder stones. So he has some health issues, but he seems to be doing well now. I just had an ultrasound yesterday, which came out clean. Everything looked good. My vet has suggested to do, now, when he did the ultrasound, it was the full abdomen. And he has suggested in 3 months to do another ultrasound, but just do the area around the anal glands and the lymph nodes. Anyway, my question is, am I missing anything? What, do you have any suggestions?
Well, just remember, I can't really make a full consult. You know, I can't really make a full consultation specific to your dog because I haven't seen a biopsy report, and it would be improper for me to really make recommendations for your dog that could, I could miss something. But in general, for anal, assuming it's an apocrine gland anal sac adenocarcinoma. I typically do recommend chemotherapy. And again, you can sometimes put more than one oncologist in the room and get different opinions. But I typically do recommend chemo. Size is important, but I do recommend chemo. Radiation, again, I will have that discussion with the owner, but again, there are a lot of side effects with that. So I don't have a lot of owners that end up doing radiation. I don't love radiating the anal gland area. One of my patients just finished radiation and did have a lot of side effects, but most of my clients don't usually do radiation. But it can help prevent recurrence because it's hard to get margins in the butt area because of the anatomy of it. One of the things I can say, just empirically, not specific to your dog, is I think ultrasounds every 3 months should be the entire abdomen, not just the anal gland area, in my humble opinion. And also chest x-rays, because this cancer can spread to the lungs as well. If you follow me on Instagram, I have a couple of, for some reason, I have a lot of anal sac dogs. I have a little Chicklet right now, and she is a dog that has spread to her lungs and has come back in her lymph nodes. So we have her on Palladia right now. I probably have like four dogs that I'm managing currently right now with anal sac tumor, which is a lot for an uncommon cancer. So just in general, chest x-rays and ultrasound, in my opinion, should be done every 3 months for the first year. Chemotherapy, I typically do recommend, but again, I can't specifically say, 100% for your dog, but those are just general recommendations that I recommend for dogs with anal sac tumors.
Thank you so much for your call.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it very much.
Good luck. You're definitely doing everything that you can. You have your hands full. Good luck.
Okay, let me ask you one more question.
Okay, we do have to run, though. I'm so sorry.
Okay, all right.
Okay, thank you. So we're in the last moment or so here, Dr. Sue. So I did want to mention for anybody listening to where they can find Dr. Sue online. So first of all, the website is drsuecancervet.com. Then also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And as we've noted, a lot of great videos on our YouTube channel, all of which I think can be found either by searching Dr. Sue or Dr. Sue Cancer Vet. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, so probably the two most active places that you'll find is YouTube, Dr. Sue Cancer Vet, new video once a week, just really touching on probably most of your cancer-related questions, both prevention, chemotherapy, how to pill a dog, top sign, warning signs of cancer, even have things on hard topics, new videos recently about euthanasia, metastasis, cancer spreading, so just some, hard topics as well, and then really active on Instagram, both in the stories and just, and those posts have a ton of information, under the pictures as well. So really just trying to provide lots of good information for people. Well, I hope anyway.
Yeah, it's really true. So before we said our goodbyes, I did want to mention all those places because, there's just great, great stuff everywhere, great information. And like you told our caller, just by chance, there's anal sac things that you're treating now. So that's covered on Instagram. But the YouTube things have just plentiful great videos and really beautifully produced and well done and so informative. So anyways, check any or all those out on the various social media platforms. So Dr. Sue, thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals, and I really appreciate it. And I think we all learned a lot. Some got some real specific guidance, some just got general guidance, all of which is very helpful for those of us who love our animals.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I had so much fun and I appreciate the opportunity.
Great. All right. Take care. Thanks again.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. In a moment, I'll play back my interview with the Paw Project's Dr. Jennifer Conrad about Banfield Pet Hospital and their recent announcement that the national chain would no longer support performing the declaw surgery. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner for Piece We Like by a guy we really like. This is Joe Zimmerman with a part of a piece called Pet Snakes in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
I have a phobia of snakes. That's normal. It's weird that people have pet snakes when there's so many fluffy pet options available. How does that go? You want the puppy? Wants to be your best friend. It's a rescue. Or you could get the cold-blooded reptile that's banging its head against the glass. Sure looks like it hates you. It's the opposite of a rescue. It's an attack. It's actually what we rescued the rescue from, so That's why we keep them separated. With bulletproof glass. Oh, you want more information on the limbless serpent? That surprises me. Let's see. I know it has infrared vision like the Predator monster. And it's been the symbol for evil since the beginning of time. Which seems like a red flag.
That does seem like a red flag. That was Joe Zimmerman with part of a piece called Pet Snakes, taken from his album Smiling at Wolves. Now let's hear the interview I recorded last night with Dr. Jennifer Conrad of the Paw Project about this new Banfield Pet Hospital policy and performing the declaw procedure. It's recorded because she's on an airplane as we speak, which, of course, rules out the usual live conversation. And by the way, afterwards, I'll reveal a major honor for Dr. Conrad that I didn't know about last night when I recorded the interview. But meanwhile, this is Dr. Jennifer Conrad on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals, Dr. Conrad.
Thanks for having me, Duncan.
Let's jump right in. First of all, what is Banfield?
Banfield is a huge conglomerate of veterinary hospitals across the country, and they are, I'm very happy to say that they have now taken the corporate policy of no more declawing cats.
Just back up for one sec, just to get a better sense of when you say big conglomerate. How many hospitals nationally would you say Banfield involves?
They have over 1,000.
Oh my goodness, okay, yeah, I knew it was big. I guess I didn't realize it was quite that big. Okay, so what had been their declaw policy before unveiling this new one?
Before, they would let each hospital decide individually, and even before that, they had many hospitals who had declawing in their kitten policy, you know, in their kitten package thing, where they actually included declawing the kitten. And now they have said, you know what, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to stop having declawing be part of what we offer because it's non-therapeutic. It helps no cats. It helps no humans. And they're doing the right thing. And I believe that it's going to be financially very rewarding for them, because people are looking for veterinarians who are humane.
Yeah, and isn't that interesting? Because as we've talked about many a time over now, many a year, I mean, part of the reason it has seemed, at least without ever being super cynical, that vets and vet hospitals did do declaws because it was a good source of additional revenue.
Exactly, but now I think that the public is becoming very wise to what it really is.
Yeah.
I think the public is putting pressure on veterinarians and saying, we don't want to go to someone who would mutilate our cat.
Right. Yeah. No, so it's great because it is, like I say, at first it's kind of counterintuitive that this would be a sort of a boon to the bookkeeping side of Banfield, but you know, it sounds like that's exactly the case now. And so is that really strictly like what motivated the change?
I think what motivated the change is that there's no good reason to declaw a cat, and we at the Paw Project have systematically proven it. We've taken away the idea that declawing saves cats' lives and keeps them in their homes. It does not.
Yeah.
We've taken away the idea that you have to declaw a cat if you have thin skin or you're on Coumadin or you have a baby in the house, because declawed cats bite more, so that makes no sense to do that to an animal. And we've taken away the fact that many people were declawing thinking that they were doing a good job for the cat. You know, a lot of people will say, I use laser and it's no pain. We've taken all that away. So now they're left with the fact that they're choosing couches over cats. It's more and more apparent to everybody that veterinarians should be choosing the cats.
So, Dr. Kayama, what role did the Paw Project play in Banfield making this shift in policy?
The Paw Project has provided Banfield and every other hospital that we know of who needs information. We provided them with all this data, all these data that show that declawing causes cats long-term problems, that declawing does not save cat lives, and that declawing does not protect human health, which leads them to the only reason to declaw a cat is for revenue. And that is not going over well anymore with the public. So these hospitals are stopping declawing because they know there's no good reason to do it, and there's only bad reasons to do it.
Well, we've already covered this, and so not to belabor it, but it's just so interesting given the kind of arc of our conversations over the years on the show, that a decision or a big motivation for making this decision is because it'll actually be better for the bottom line to stop doing declaw when for years that's by almost all accounts that's why people did do declaw, was to bring in some extra dough. So anyway,
yeah, unfortunately people are short-sighted on that, because when you are a veterinarian who chooses the cat over the couches, people flock to you because they feel like, okay, this is someone who really cares about my animal, and that's right. What matters to me.
Well, so we just have towards the end of our time for our brief conversation today, Dr. Kahneman, but what would you say beyond Banfield, but based on Banfield making this policy change, what are the implications?
The implications is one of the biggest corporations in veterinary medicine has now decided that it is more profitable to not declaw cats than to declaw cats, and that it is better for their hospitals to not have their staff be upset by watching cats wake up from declawing and their staff quit. They now have people who feel that they are attached to their hospital because their hospital does the right thing for animals.
And do you think along those lines that this will persuade other large vet hospital operations or even smaller ones to follow suit? I mean, this just seems like it would have a huge, profound impact on operations large and small.
I believe that it does have a big impact on other chains. It puts pressure on them.
Yeah.
And it also shows that people, you can choose cat to, and you can do the right thing and you don't lose money.
Okay, well, more reasons to be cheerful, as a song used to say. So this sounds very cool, very encouraging. Dr. Conrad, thank you again. We'll be talking about one thing or another on the declaw topic, I know, and I'm hoping it's something Florida related over the coming months or beyond.